what I wanted to do today, because I thought the topic we had last week was so important, and then second, because I feel I didn't do a thorough enough job in discussing it. So I want to kind of repeat that, or not repeat, but fill in some more details on this whole idea of Vatican II. So I was trying to find an article, I finally found it, that I had written for the Reign of Mary, and this was in issue number 148, the fall of 2012. Now, 2012 was the 50th anniversary of the beginning of Vatican II, which began, I think it was October 11th, 1962. And lasted till December of 1965. So I wanted to do an article on what Vatican II was all about on the 50th anniversary of the beginning of Vatican II. And I would like to start by saying, when new people come who, you know, don't know much about the church and what's happened in the church, etc., and I'm talking to them, I usually start by saying to them this: if you could go back in a time machine to the 1950s and observe what goes on in the churches, observe the way Catholic schools are run, listen to the sermons of priests, that's what it's like here. I mean, it's like we're just doing what was done before the 1960s came. Because the 1960s were an incredibly confusing and topsy-turvy time, not just in society, but of course in the church with Vatican II. So I wanted to list what I can see as the errors of Vatican II primarily. Now, one of the things I want to say about Vatican II that you'll find, if you were to read the documents, you would find a, what I would call a wordiness. In other words, goes on and on and on, instead of cutting to the chase and just saying, this is what the church teaches. A lot of words. Well, when you have something that's very long, you can slip in little things here and there more easily than you could if it's concise. You would recognize the error more easily. And I mentioned last time that John the 23rd, who called Vatican II at the opening session, said, we're not going to condemn any error, we're just going to hold out what the church teaches to try and draw people to the church. He also said that he was updating, and the expression was used, we have to bring the church up to date with the modern world. And one of the expressions that you find often in the documents in Vatican II is this expression, modern man. We have to make the church relevant to modern man. So that was the mantra, that was the excuse that was used for a lot of the updating and the changing. Now, I wrote down here the popes, or supposed popes, that there have been since the death of Pope Pius XII. So Pope Pius XII died in 1958. He was elected Pope in 1939, so he had an 18 and a half year reign, actually 19 and a half years, I guess. Yeah, 19 and a half years, because he was elected in March, I think like March 1st or March 2nd, 1939. He died on October 9th, or the night of the 8th to 9th, 1958. Everything. While Pope Pius XII was Pope, everything remained as it had been. There was orthodoxy, heresy was condemned, etc. And I think I told you the story last week about Bishop McKenna, who was ordained in June of 1958, and he told me that when Pope Pius XII died, he said all of a sudden there were these priests that he had admired for their knowledge and their orthodoxy, meaning they were right down the line, all of a sudden they started teaching new things. So it was like, here's this one man held back like the boy with his finger in the dike. He held back all of the errors by his mere authority and firmness, etc. Highly regarded by everyone, people of all faiths, etc., for his obvious holiness and goodness and so forth. But when he died, everything began to change. Now, John the 23rd called for Vatican II, but he died after Vatican II started. He died about 7-8 months later. As I said, it started in October of 1962, and then John the 23rd died the following summer. I don't remember, June or July, in the summer. Then Giovanni Battista Montini, a cardinal, was elected as the next pope, or supposed pope, Paul VI, and he's the one that brought Vatican II completion. He promulgated all the documents of Vatican II, and he changed the Mass, he changed all the sacraments, and really changed everything in Catholic practice and teaching. He died in August 6th, I think it was, 1978, and the one that was elected to take his place took the name John Paul I. And he said the reason he took that name, because it never in the history of the Catholic Church for 2,000 years was there a pope that took two names. It was like Clement the 10th and Boniface the 8th and Urban and, you know, a name and then a number for which one of that number. And he said the reason he took the names of John, the two names, John Paul, is because he wanted to continue the reforms of his two predecessors. And it's very interesting. If you were to read, for example, because he only lasted for 33 days, he died almost certainly poisoned, and that's another story altogether, but he was not poisoned or gotten out of the way because he wanted to go back to the way things were. In fact, he refused to be crowned as pope. And there was a ceremony of coronation, and he just had an installation, like becoming a president or something. And so he was not a traditionalist. He, again, wanted to continue the reforms. But he died after 33 days, and then this cardinal from Poland was elected, Wojtyla. And as you can see, he was the supposed pope for more than 25 years, about 27 years. That's an incredibly long period of time for a papacy, or a supposed papacy. And he, John Paul II, traveled all over the world, and he had interfaith services with all different religions, practitioners of all these different religions. And so he's the one that took Vatican II, that Paul VI promulgated, and he made it, he interpreted what it meant and put it into practice, and especially that has to do with ecumenism and interfaith, which we'll get to. So he died, he had Parkinson's disease, so some of the photos, some of the video of you'll see of him, those that maybe you're too young or don't remember, you know, he's kind of hunched over the last few years of his life from Parkinson's. But he died in 2005, and then the cardinal that was his, like, head theologian under him was Joseph Ratzinger, was elected in 2005, I think April, and he resigned in the end of February of 2013. He's still alive. He calls himself the Pope Emeritus. Lives in the Vatican, and then when he resigned, the conclave that met elected this Archbishop of Buenos Aires, Argentina, whose name is Jorge Bergoglio. So Jorge is Spanish for George, so that's his name, Bergoglio. Bergoglio was it on his father's side as Italian. Like his grandfather, someone came over to Argentina from Italy. So he's part Italian and born and raised in Argentina. So he's been there ever since. He took the name Francis, and maybe one of the big things that he is known for is he really emphasizes the environment. He's big on the climate change and all that kind of thing. And he's even put out an encyclical on the environment, which is interesting because the role of the Pope is to save souls. You know, your concern should be the salvation of souls, and his whole concern seems to be this world, you know, having a better world here. That's what he talks about all the time. But many other things we could talk about there. But I want to go back to Vatican II, and I want to briefly explain what I see as the main errors of Vatican II. Now, I mentioned that the documents are very wordy, very long. And the other thing you see in the writings of Vatican II is this word, ambiguity. Kind of a long word. I spelled it wrong. They're ambiguous. The documents are ambiguous. So this is what we see in the... I got it wrong again. I should just write the adjective, ambiguous. That's a little easier than ambiguity. Ambiguous. The documents are ambiguous. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples. And you tell me, what is this document saying? So this is just quoting from Vatican II. The wrong page here. All right. Vatican II documents are filled with contradictory instructions. The Council will commend one action while also saying that the opposite may be permitted. In its constitution, for example, on the sacred liturgy, which opened the door for all kinds of liturgical experimentation and the Novus Ordo, in that document it says, quote, this is from the actual document of Vatican II on Latin, the use of the Latin language is to be preserved in the Latin Rite, unquote, section 36, paragraph 1 of the document on the liturgy. But then it goes on to say, in the very same section, but, has the word but. It'll say one thing, it'll say but. So this one, it says, but since the use of the mother tongue, whether in the Mass, the administration of the sacraments, or other parts of the liturgy, may frequently be of great advantage to the people, the limits of its employment may be extended. So it's saying the local language, you know, your English or French or German, since that can be benefit to the people, we can extend that. Well, now what happens? The Novus Ordo is completely in the language of the people. And yet it says Latin was to be preserved. They stopped teaching Latin for the most part in the seminaries. If you talk to a priest nowadays that has been ordained within the last 30 years, he probably doesn't even know any Latin. So, but Latin is the language of the church. But that's an example of contradictory statements. And so what happens then, the liberals use Vatican II, and they'll quote it, they'll use Vatican II and say, see, we can do what we're doing. And the conservatives will say, no, you're misinterpreting it. That's not supposed to be done. And then they'll quote it. And so that's what I mean by the ambiguous. The ambiguity that it doesn't lay down the teachings or the laws very, very clearly. Here's another example from the Decree on Ecumenism, quote, as for common worship, however, it may not be regarded as a means to be used indiscriminately for the restoration of unity among Christians. The fact that it should signify unity generally rules out common worship. Yet, the gaining of a needed grace sometimes commends it. So you tell me what that's saying. So it's saying, well, common worship and you believe different things and you're worshiping together, that's not a good idea. But sometimes it needs to be done. So that's just very typical of the way the documents are worded. Now, I want to just to go through these, what I see as the seven main errors of Vatican II. And this is just my own view of it from what I've read of the documents, and there may be other things. Someone else might point out other things. But we'll just go through these. First of all, a false notion of the church. Pope Pius XII wrote an encyclical on the church, and he said the Catholic Church is the church founded by Christ. The church founded by Christ is the Catholic Church. We can think of a mathematical equation with an equal sign. It's the same thing. The church Christ founded is the Catholic Church. But then Vatican II teaches the Catholic Church subsists in the Church of Christ, or the Church of Christ subsists in the Catholic Church, which is another way, you can get him out of here, which is another way of saying that the Catholic Church is not equal to the Church of Christ. So the Church founded by Christ is big. It's like this big umbrella, and the Catholic Church is part of it. And you got the Anglican Church, you got the Greek Orthodox, you got others that are part of it. And that's the same heresy from England, what was called the branch theory that was taught by the Anglicans. So that's a false notion of the church. Second, Vatican II actually says that the church, The Catholic Church has need of continual reformation, like an ongoing process forever. It always has to be reformed. Well, it's one thing if you're talking about the behavior of the members of the church and there needs to be improvement. But it's another thing when you're talking about the doctrines, the teaching of the church. All right. Third, Vatican II taught that non-Catholic religions are, or at least can be, means of salvation. But we would say, no, the Catholic Church is the only church found by Christ. He founded one church. It's the true church. If someone outside the Catholic Church cooperates with grace and ends up saving his immortal soul, it's not because of the false religion that he's part of. That religion that was founded by a man cannot be a means of saving one's soul. Vatican II also had a false idea of hierarchy where it elevated the bishops almost to the level of the Pope, and the Pope became now more kind of like the chairman of the board. Instead of this hierarchical idea where the Pope has supreme authority and then the bishops are under him, so now they have all these synods every few years, and that's something that Vatican II started. It's called... slipping my mind, what's the name they use for that? I'll think of it in a minute. But they have a name for that this new idea of the hierarchy. Destruction of the liturgy, we talked about. Vatican II started all of the changes in the Mass that led to a Protestantized liturgy. Vatican II taught a false religious liberty. Now that's a big one, and I want to talk about that for a minute. It's very interesting. Before Vatican II, it had been defined, solemnly defined, that no one has a right to a false religion. In other words, a right is something that comes from God. God can't give you a right to believe in heresy, right? Because heresy is contrary to his nature. God is truth. So he doesn't give people a right to believe in heresy, in error. But Vatican II, well, let me also preface it by saying, but the Catholic Church also teaches that everyone has a free will and you can't force people to become Catholics. You can't force someone to believe in what the Catholic Church teaches. You can pray for their conversion, you can explain the faith to them, but you can't force them to be a Catholic. Okay? So we would say the Catholic Church teaches that everyone is free from coercion. You can't coerce someone to be a Catholic. But Vatican II took this idea of freedom from, and then they said everyone is free to worship God however he wants. So when they talk about religious liberty at Vatican II, they're saying everyone has a right, has a God-given right to worship God however he chooses. And that is a false notion that's been condemned by the church before. And in fact, it's funny, the book I have on Vatican II, the documents of Vatican II, the priest who edited the book, he has a footnote there. And he says, I don't understand how this can be. This doesn't square with what the church taught before, but I'm sure the theologians sometime down in the future will figure out a way how it squares with previous teaching of the church. In other words, there's a leap here, and there's not a connection to it. There's a gap. There's this previous teaching, and now there's this new teaching, and how are we going to show that there's a continuity? So, and that's been a big matter of controversy. But Vatican II took this idea of freedom from coercion and changed it from a negative to a positive, said, therefore, you're free to worship God however you choose. So it taught a false idea of religious liberty. And finally, false ecumenism, which we're going to see on some video here. False ecumenism is this idea of meeting together with various religions. Now, Paul VI did it a little bit. But ecumenism was especially something that was promoted and practiced by John Paul II. Like I said, he went all over the world. And one of the things that he did, John Paul II, is he called for a prayer meeting in Assisi. I mentioned this briefly last class, I think. In 1986, it was like October 27th or October 28th, 1986, in which representatives of all these different religions were called together to Assisi, Italy, to pray for peace. And you actually had practitioners of voodoo, Zoroastrianism, and all the, you know, Hindus and all these different religions to come together. So that's a sin against the first commandment. You know, God said, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have strange gods before me. So this is what we talked about last class, modernism. Modernism believes that whatever religion, ultimately God is the one behind that religion. And that the reason there are different religions is because of different cultures and different upbringing, etc. But ultimately, God is the author of all of these, ultimately. So I wanted to at least cover that in a little bit more detail than we did last time. Okay, so, collegiality is the word. I couldn't think of the word they use for this idea of the hierarchy where there's this collegiality among the bishops and the Pope, instead of the Pope being up here and the bishops down here underneath. All right. Now, after the last class, somebody asked me if I could give you some quotes from Francis, the so-called Pope right now. And I did some research, but I wanted to find something that would just list a lot of these quotes. One of the things, for example, he said, you know, early on, the first couple years after he was elected, there were all of these big whoppers, things he would say that people were like, yikes. And one of the things he said is that proselytism is solemn nonsense. Solemn nonsense. So he doesn't believe you should try to convert anyone. And in fact, he even said to the Jews that it's forbidden for Catholics to try to convert Jews. And there was this is after he had been elected just within the first couple years, there was a Protestant minister that he had known before when he was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires. And this man wanted to become a Catholic. And he spoke to Francis about this. And Francis said, no, stay where you are. We need people like you in other religions that can be bridge builders, build a bridge between that religion and us. You know, so he told him not to convert. And sadly, that man was killed in a motorcycle accident within, you know, 6 or 8 months after that had happened. Now, one of the websites that I use is called Novus Ordo Watch. It's a very good website. And if you go over, Novus Ordo Watch has just got so many articles and things in it. But it starts here with a home page and about, etc. And then Novus Ordo Wire is where I go. And then it has a bunch of other things. And what the author here, that the webmaster here that puts these things together, what he will do, see, this is his latest post, was on May the 12th. What was that? 2 days ago, that Francis called upon all faiths to pray for an end to coronavirus on May 14th, to have an interfaith service on the 14th of May. But as I go down, you're going to see, so this is his post on the 11th. All right, so you just go down and it has these different posts, and I wanted to just, there's a lot of good things that would be very helpful. This is a picture of Benedict the 16th, who is still alive, who says he's the Pope Emeritus. All right, look at that, modern church. That's another thing, since Vatican II, the modern architecture. But you see where it says read more? Each one of these has a longer article. But I wanted to show you this one because I had mentioned it briefly last week. Francis jokes with an autistic, says, boy, a young man. So this is posted on May the 2nd. So this is what happened. Says, read the whole article. He says, we all know that Jorge Bergoglio is a funny chap. Not only does he like to dress up as Pope, he also loves to tell hilarious jokes. For example, he's humorously called the Holy Ghost a disaster. He's blasphemously mocked the unity of the Holy Trinity, and he has not been ashamed to misuse the holy crucifixion of Christ as the punchline of a joke. And if you click on, you see these that are underlined, that's a, what do you call it, a hyperlink? You could go onto each of those and it would give you the article he's referring to, the event. Not surprisingly, he also likes to encourage altar boys to treat Holy Mass as a joke, and the pious he likes to embarrass in front of a camera. Francis Funnybone manifested itself again this past Wednesday, April 29th, when he called the family of an 18-year-old autistic boy who had written him about the liturgical sign of peace during the times of coronavirus. The young man's name is Andrea Baruffi, and Francis' call was answered by his mother, Maria Teresa, who put his wittiness on speakerphone as her son and husband listened in. In an article released today, the Novus Ordo news site Crux reports on what transpired on the phone call. Pope Francis called, closed the call, offering the family his blessing and asking for prayer, but not before making a small joke with Baruffi, who told him that, quote, "We pray a lot for you, but you don't need it. You are already a saint." Jesting, he laughed and said, "Who knows? Maybe we'll see each other in hell." To which Baruffi replied, "I think for you, no, but us, perhaps. We're a little bit mean with everyone in this situation." So that's what I was referring to last week. And it actually has, this would be in Italian, you know, it has the call, because the call was recorded and so forth. But I mean, you know, can you imagine saying something like that? What a terrible thing to say. But there's a lot on this Novus Ordo watch, and especially under Novus Ordo wire. So when I have time, I'll go and read that, and it kind of keeps up with what's going on in the Novus Ordo Church.